You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins. You may not know it, but you're left-handed. Not the hand you use the most, but the amino acids and the molecules that make up your body. All life on Earth uses left-handed building blocks. And a research team led by Associate Western Michigan University Physics Professor Michael Famiano is trying to find out why that's true and whether the stuff of life was forged in the depths of space.
Amino acids are what we call asymmetric. You can't make a mirror image of them, just like your hands. Your hands, you have a left hand and a right hand, and you can't in any way rotate your right hand or flip it in any way so that it looks exactly like your left hand. Amino acids are like that, too. We call that chirality. That comes from the Greek word for hand. And so amino acids have a handedness. And if you look at them, they're identical. The left-handed and the right-handed ones are identical. They're just mirror images of each other. And so there's no reason to believe that one amino acid is any better than the other one in terms of biology. But the interesting thing is all of life only uses left-handed amino acids. We call them left and right-handed amino acids, and that's kind of arbitrary which one is which, but we've labeled them based on their orientations. So everything that is alive only has left-handed ones. You, me, plants, animals, your pets, your house plants. And we're not sure why. We're not sure how it got to be that way. We think that maybe you started off with maybe a little bit of left-handed ones, and then it went through what we call an autocatalysis process, where you completely amplified so that everything becomes left-handed. But that's one of the big questions in science today. Why are we left-handed? Why are we not right-handed?
For a long, long time, there's been speculation that perhaps, to quote a sci-fi TV show from the 1970s, perhaps life arose out there and not on Earth and came to Earth in some fashion, or at least the building blocks of life. And I gather that you and your team here at Western have discovered some things about this topic, because amino acids have been found in meteors that have fallen to Earth, for example. They show this left-handed, predominantly this left-handed orientation. So what are the implications of that?
Yeah, that is really interesting. So, the fact that the amino acids in life are left-handed is fascinating. The fact that we found amino acids in space is fascinating. But the fact that we have evidence that the ones we found in space are predominantly left-handed has implications that boggle the mind. And so it's not a large logical step to assume this really science fiction-y, Star Trek-y kind of assumption that of panspermia, that whatever exists on Earth may have been brought to Earth, or at least influenced by what fell on the Earth. We know that there was a period of intense meteoric bombardment prior to life arising on Earth. And so it's not as far-fetched as it sounds. And certainly if you talk about the idea of panspermia to a biologist or to a geologist, they won't shut you down. They won't shun you as a scientist. It's a valid field of research.
Do you think that view is becoming more common, that perhaps something fell on the Earth and then that triggered the process versus, molecules just sort of randomly coming together in some pond somewhere a billion years ago?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm going to confess I'm a physicist, not a biologist. So I can tell you what limited knowledge I know, and I'm going to betray my poor knowledge of biology. As far as I know, there's a couple schools of thought. I've heard people use the terms little warm ponds, where maybe life originated in that. And whether or not life amplified what was already there, or whether or not what was there was brought to the Earth and then it produced life is kind of an open question still.
You and your team apparently have discovered and have written a paper about something going on in space which may explain why there's this predominance of left-handed amino acids out there.
Yeah. So this is tending more to the biochemistry side of things. But anytime you see something in nature that's imbalanced, it's always fascinating. Nature has a lot of symmetry to it, but it also has a lot of asymmetry to it as well. And so we're trying to figure out how in the world these amino acids could have become predominantly left-handed. And there's several theories about that, and they're all really good theories. People thought maybe circularly polarized light may have contributed to that. People thought maybe magnetic fields contribute to that. What we came up with what's called an emergent phenomenon, where you have several little independent pieces which come together to produce an amplified mechanism, something that makes it bigger, whereas one of those little pieces really doesn't contribute. And so this model involves magnetic fields and electric fields, both of which you find in space in huge numbers and huge magnitudes. And it also involves molecular interactions with the surrounding leptons. And these could be things like electrons. We're considering neutrino interactions.
These are extremely small particles.
Yeah, very tiny. Neutrinos, for all intents and purposes, are massless, although the Nobel Prize recently was awarded for giving them mass. But the thing about neutrinos is that they have what's called a distinct helicity. As they propagate in space, they can only spin one way. Antineutrinos, which are the opposite particle of neutrinos, can only spin the other way. Now, how they got to be like that is a completely different question. But now we have an interaction with something that has to spin a certain way with the nuclei involved in a molecule. And that interaction can selectively destroy one molecule over the other. If they're in a magnetic field, if they're oriented in a magnetic field and an electric field. So those three mechanisms cause that interaction. And, of course, the big question is, where do we find all those three things together? There's not too hard to find that stuff in space. Type 2 supernova, exploding stars, neutron stars have very intense magnetic fields and neutrinos. Neutron star mergers, which also won a Nobel Prize recently, have very intense magnetic fields and neutrinos. So it's not hard to find in space. So we think this is plausible. We've done some calculations. As far as we know, this is one of the most quantitative models to date in which we can predict this.
Do you think it has implications for how widespread life of any kind, but also intelligent life, would be elsewhere in the universe?
Yeah, that is a great question. This is more of a philosophical question. So the rarity of these events, of course, is going to dictate the rarity of life, right? And there's theories that the Earth formed in sort of the junk that was made in a Type 2 supernova, the matter that was expelled into space, which would make a nice environment to produce and select amino acids. So is it possible that life was delivered to other planets in our galaxy? Certainly. The question of how rare that is really tough to answer. And there's a lot of astronomers looking for life on these exoplanets that they found. Another interesting question is that life left-handed or is it right-handed? Is there a planet out there that's right-handed? You know, are there people like us out here that use the opposite kinds of amino acids? So those kinds of questions are still very wide open.
What drew you personally into this line of research?
Yeah, I'm a nuclear physicist by trade, which means I spend most of my time underground working in accelerators. Astrophysics is closely related to nuclear physics because everything that produces energy in space is nuclear. But I've been working on this for about 20 years now, off and on. My thesis advisor in grad school told me about this. I immediately became hooked. The question is immensely difficult. Only maybe in the past 3 years, we started to make a little bit of headway, at least in the mathematical side of things.
Fairly recently, I believe there was some news that one of the probes wandering around Mars finally found some indication of some organic chemicals. So far, what we've been talking about have been molecules that have fallen on the Earth, you know, from space rocks, basically. Do you think that discoveries like that on Mars would help advance work in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. There's sort of three main main branches of searches for organic chemicals in space. The observational astronomers, so radio and IR astronomers.
That's infrared.
Infrared, yep. Are looking towards, first of all, identifying organic molecules, which they can do. They can find them in star-forming regions. A little more difficult to identify the chirality, the handedness of these molecules. And by a little more difficult, it would be a technical miracle if they could do this. I would be very amazed. We've looked for organic molecules in comets. So you've probably heard about this comet probe that was launched probably in the past decade. One of the instruments on that was in place to look at organic molecules. And then planetary missions, where we can land on planets and take actual samples to look for organic molecules. This is a big push by NASA. It's a big push in the astronomical and what we call the astrobiological community.
Would you care to speculate on, what's next?
Yeah, it's still a wide open question. If you were to ask me how amino acids became chiral, the best answer I could give you is I don't know. Even though we've written papers on this, we want to be honest and say we're not the only game out there. I personally would like to do an experiment on what we've been working on. These types of experiments are really difficult. Based on the model, we're going to need a source of polarized leptons, which we can do. But the cross-sections, meaning the probability of even getting an interaction, is tiny. The reason it works in space is because there's so many of them. So I think experimentally verifying this is important. This is sort of how science works. You come up with an idea. You might do some hypotheses. You do some calculations, and then you say, "Well, okay, a theory without experimental proof is just a theory." And so that's where we're moving right now.
Nuclear physics is, I guess, the classic image it forms in people's minds of Einstein and people like that, and all kinds of crazy mathematical things on the board that very few people really understand. But do you find that when you're working in this area, particularly with your students, do they find this a very engaging mode of research?
Depends on the student. The nice thing about science and physics is it's pretty broad. You can do what you want. So, I have plenty of students who are interested in nuclear physics. Some of them like to mess with shiny things. They like to do experiments. Some of them like to sit at a computer and do calculations. The nice thing is you can always find all kinds of students who are willing to do a broad spectrum. And taken together, you've got a great research team. So you've got students all over the place who can do all sorts of things. They have different talents, they have different capabilities, and they have different interests. So you find the right project and the right student and match them together, and you've really got a powerful combination there because you've got the enthusiasm along with the interest. Yeah, one thing you mentioned, which really I thought was interesting, was you mentioned, people that when they think of science, they think of Einstein and all the amazing scientists out there and things they read in the news. What you see in the news is you always see the end result, and people think of a scientist as sitting in a lab and he has this eureka moment where he, runs up and down shouting, "Yay, we found it, we found it." Well, science kind of works that way. But to get to that end result takes years and years and years of work. And it's a lot of hard work punctuated by a little bit of a couple of those aha moments. I like to tell people 99% of what I do doesn't work. But it's that 1% that takes a lot of hard work to get to. So it's kind of a neat perception of science from the inside.
It's not science like you see in the movies or on TV.
Right. That'd be a very boring movie if it were like it really was in real life.
Michael Famiano is an associate professor of physics at Western Michigan University. You've been listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins. Thanks for listening.